So welcome to Adventist Voices, Spectrum's podcast. I'm Alexander Carpenter, and I'm honored to be here with an Adventist filmmaker, Kyle Portbury. Thanks for being willing to talk to us today.
Hey, my pleasure. And it's also very cool that you're honored.
Yes. Yeah. We say that.
It's nice to be honored on a Friday morning at like whatever it is, like 11 a.m. or something.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm honored not only because you're here, but you are about to release a film, The Hopeful, in April. And so we want to talk about you as a filmmaker. You've had a really fascinating career making art in
and
around.
That's exactly how my wife articulates it as well.
Interesting career.
Yeah. So you have a really fascinating career.
Yeah. So, we'll kind of talk about that fascinating career and the things that you've made and how you've made them and ways that folks can watch The Hopeful.
Yes.
So maybe let's start with The Hopeful. What is it?
Well, The Hopeful is a absolutely gorgeous 90-minute period drama that's pretty much Kyle's love letter to his Adventist roots. So it charts the course of anticipation through disappointment and out the other side with perseverance.
Nice.
Obey his word and believe. There is no time for delay.
I believe the Bible is clear. Jesus will return in but 4 short years.
I come before you today to tell you that I have been shown in vision.
Father Miller's message was light. The Advent people were traveling on a path toward a bright and holy city.
This is not the first time the end of the world has been prophesied by a fool, nor will it be the last. If you do not renounce these radical ideas, you will not be welcome here in this house of worship.
This was only the beginning of our journey.
Her visions do not come from God. But my friends, she speaks with great tenderness of the word of the Lord.
The Holy Spirit encouraged our Advent hope. There were people who didn't listen and they fell off the path.
You really believe this doctrine which you preach?
I was lost, and now I'm found.
We must follow the word of God over the rule of men. We feel love, the love of Jesus. It lifts us up, it carries us forward.
And it will guide us home.
I like that.
And it's a really, I guess it's a really personal take on that story in the sense that we're looking really deeply at what characters want and why they were motivated to, like, why did they want to anticipate the soon return of Christ in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Like, what was that all about? And then when that didn't pan out the way that they hoped that it would.
October 22, 1844.
Interestingly enough, it's 2024. So what's that? It's like 170 years.
Let's
is my math
see.
Correct? It's probably incorrect.
No, it's 180.
100. Yeah. 180. I was only 10 years shy.
Yeah, you're an artist, not a mathematician.
That's exactly it. That's what I tell my kids. Like, you don't have to be good at everything.
That's right.
Somebody else will know the answer.
That's right. Like your phone.
Like your phone. Thank you, ChatGPT.
So let's talk a little bit about that history, because you have a really interesting way of framing this story. It's been told a lot of ways. Every Adventist knows part of this story, at least. You start in the middle of the ocean with a family, the J.N. Andrews family.
Yeah.
Why did you choose it? Why did you choose to start it that way?
Well, I'm a bit of an aficionado of, like, old cinema. So I kind of, which I got a love for, actually, was a really cool tutor that I had at Drama Center, because I trained professionally in London as an actor back in the 2000s. I hadn't really ever engaged that much with cinema history, hadn't really watched that many old films. So I think when I went to Drama Center in 2005, I was maybe 26, 27 years old. and we had a class called Understanding Film, and she started showing us all of the great works from cinema history, just clips of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Drama Centre, being part of University of the Arts London, like, had this huge library that you could then go and take any film. That was back in the days of DVDs, and I believe that they still had a very large VHS collection at nice. That time. They also housed Stanley Kubrick's entire archive, so you could actually go in there with, like, the gloves on and as a student and request to get, like, scripts of his for, like, films like Barry Lyndon and stuff. So you could sit down and look at the notes on the side of the scripts.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know that you can do that anymore.
Yeah.
I haven't checked in a long time. Maybe as an alumni, it'd be cool to go back down there and do that. But they had props and all sorts of stuff. So I got a really, because of that immersion and, mm-hmm. and how passionate Pamela was about the history of cinema, you suddenly just got your eyes opened to, there's a whole, like, visual literacy that I had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
It's culturally, you know, where I was brought up in that part of Australia in that era, in that Adventism community, that artistic dive into cinema wasn't really a thing that anyone did. No yeah. one I knew did that.
Yeah.
You know, there was no real appreciation. I think the first movie I ever watched in the cinema was Finding Nemo in like 1990-something. You know.
So is that why you started the Adventist story in the middle of the water?
That's it. That's exactly why I started it in the middle of the water. I kind of really love films like Princess Bride.
Yeah.
And I really like those. The structure
of that story.
Structurally, those sorts of storytelling devices where you kind of may have moments where the audience is like, hang on a minute, what's going on right now? Like, it's a really cool device to be able to have a family you've already got to know on this ship be able to, like, pop in for a second and let you off the hook, right? And be like, I'm not 100% sure what's going on here. And then you let the audience have that same experience of, like, going, oh, phew, like, neither did I. Because actually some of those concepts around prophecy, for instance, you know, when you hear Miller talking about why 1843 and then 1844, it's kind of useful to have the daughter pop up and go, this is really confusing.
Yeah.
Because it is.
Yeah.
And then it lets you off the hook and you can move on with the story, right?
Yeah.
So
explain what you're, you know, they're sort of on this ship, they're going to Europe, they're the first Adventist missionaries, and they're explaining kind of what they're doing and why.
Yeah.
Is that what the story's about? Is the story for you about, or is the film about trying to help people understand what we're doing and why today?
Not in that, like, this happened and then that happened and then this happened and that happened way. But I think when you can engage with characters.
Yeah.
Who have similar wants and desires and hopes and dreams.
And you're thinking of
failings.
Ellen White as a character.
Yeah, and William Miller and James White, her husband, Joseph Bates and his wife Prudence.
Yeah.
Miller's wife Lucy, who's a fabulous character.
Uh-huh.
You know, these guys are very much just like us. You know, we're kind of fortunate that we've got a lot of correspondence between all of them.
Yeah.
So they wrote extensively and not in ways that we write anymore. So the level of detail that they would correspond between each other is just really rich. So you get this really clear sense in their letters to each other or their writings about certain events or philosophy of what they'd learned from biblical research. So you get a real understanding of who this person was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you go, wow, this person in the 1800s actually is not too dissimilar to me, right? Like, they look at certain things with skepticism sometimes, and they're not necessarily going, I'm just buying that, right? Like, they're really testing it and pushing it and playing with the edges of what they're actually looking at or what they're talking through or what they've discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you connect with a real character and you get provoked and challenged by the way that you see them respond to anticipation or respond to disappointment or respond to that disappointment through perseverance, I like being provoked by how would I have responded in that situation. You know, I think about it today and I go, it's far easier to be cynical than it is to persevere.
Yeah.
Right? Like you look at all of the possibilities that you have. It's much easier to look around at the people who are looking at you and go, it's a bit vulnerable to show people that I'm passionate about something, right? Because what are they going to think about? Are they going to agree with that passion? Are they going to? It's much easier to just be cynical about stuff. It's the path of least resistance that helps us get through all sorts of awkward situations.
Yeah.
So I look at what this group of people decided to do with the events that they were handed and the circumstances that were handed. And I'm challenged by, would I have been one of those people that stuck with it?
Yeah.
Through that disappointment? Or would I have simply just been like, man, the heat, there's a lot of heat right now.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know the answer to that because I haven't been put in that situation. Sure. And I like seeing characters and I like being challenged and provoked by stories that make me question whether or not my assumption of would I be the hero in this story is actually true or not.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great scene in Saving Private Ryan right at the beginning. Tom Hanks is standing there in the landing boat and they're about to land on the thing in D-Day. And you look at that and you go, I feel myself in Tom Hanks in this moment. But in reality, unfortunately, you'd probably be the guy standing right in front of him who, as soon as the thing drops down,
yeah.
is war's over. He gets shot in the head and he's done.
Yeah.
You know, so I like, and I appreciate when stories go there in that regard, where they challenge you about how you would be if you were placed in that situation.
Yeah. Well, there's a scene that your Ellen White, James White relationship is, I think, very humanizing for both of those figures.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about how you chose to create those characters? Obviously, you're drawing on history. They're real. But you're also putting them into a situation that feels kind of, there's conflict, there's pain.
Yeah.
What were you trying to do in that scene? And what were you, what truth were you finding in Ellen and James?
Mm. Well, I think that they're actually real people, right? Like, so I think sometimes we look at historical figures through the lens of myth, which has been created over like decades. And in this case, like a century or more of myth that as a culture we've built up.
Yeah.
And then they cease to become actually relevant anymore because, well, I couldn't possibly ever attain the kind of understanding or experience that they had.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's too rarefied at this point up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read, again, you go back into that correspondence and you rely on the person you discover within that writing, right? Like, particularly when they're writing personal correspondence either between themselves or it's one of them writing to a friend about that relationship.
Yeah.
There's a fabulous set of letters. There's about six of them in the White Estate archives. And they're past where the film finishes, but they give you a really great insight into how that relationship worked. I mean, I think I had one Adventist historian one time tell me that, you know, James and Ellen weren't really in love. It was just a marriage of convenience.
Hmm.
And you're like, they had four kids. That seems like a very inconvenient marriage if you're just doing it to like get by, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of didn't buy that. And also didn't buy it when I read how they spoke about each other and the struggle, like real, actual, passionate struggle between the needs of the mission that they felt called to and the family that sometimes took a backseat to
them.
And paid a heavy price for, right?
Yeah.
And so that scene that you're talking about, you know, it's James and Ellen, there's a baby on the hip, you know, that kid's upset, which babies generally are, like they either need feeding or, you know, they're teething or they need to go to the bathroom or whatever it be, right? Like, so there's stuff always up at that like early stage of kids. And I've had that conversation with my wife before, not in that context, not about should we go to a Bible conference, you know, wherever it was. But I've certainly had it on, should I go to this film festival? That would be a really great idea.
Yeah.
Kyle, but what about the needs of our family?
Yeah.
Right? Sure. What do you want me to do? Stay home and like look after and do this by myself?
Did that happen when you went to South by Southwest?
Oh, dude, it happens all like, so literally I got over to the States about 3 weeks ago. We're 3 weeks into an 8 week stint of that right now,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a price to be paid. Even when you really passionately believe, as she does as well, like it's a family decision when you're doing these crazy things and making movies and then promoting them. But there's still a toll, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's really valuable for us, particularly as Adventists, to get an understanding that just because the people have an experience that seems extraordinary.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they don't still grapple with the ordinary.
Yeah, great.
You know? And I think that's really important to challenge anyone with that. You don't need to be Adventist to be challenged by that, right? Like, it needs to be relatable so that you go, okay, this story that I'm on, this roller coaster of this journey with these characters and this world that they're in and these big issues that they're facing, actually really relatable to me in 2024, right? Like, I anticipate, you anticipate, you know? I get disappointed by loads of stuff. I got disappointed by the coffee at the hotel this morning. I was sitting in there going, oh, this is not as good as I expected it should have been.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
And so then I went and sought out. You know, my disappointment was met with perseverance.
That's right. Like Ellen White. For a greater truth
I looked for a greater cup of coffee and persevered. She did say once that the coffee was to be avoided. But then I figured that she's left you some wiggle room within there. Because to be avoided means that there's some space to still have it.
Okay. You know? All right.
She didn't say don't. Or maybe she did. I don't know. By the by,
coffee was different back then. It was so disgusting. She was warning us away from bad coffee.
Bad coffee.
I feel like she would enjoy a little third wave.
Yeah, I coffee. Think so. But yeah, the coffee that I persevered towards was well worth the
good
the extra effort this morning.
The Adventist spirit is alive.
is alive and well in my gut biome right now.
Well, on your gut, let's transition.
That's a great that was a good segue. I don't know where this is.
What in your gut led you to create such great music for your film?
Yeah, nice.
Because you're not just thinking visually here. You really brought in professionals to create an audioscape that is beyond the normal Adventist cinematic experience.
And in some way, you know, it's kind of unique in just general cinema experience, actually, too. Not that we set out necessarily to do that, but it's one of those things of it's what happens when you're open to being influenced by your collaborators in a really, like, very open, you pitch stuff and I'm going to let that affect me as it does, right? Rather than just going, actually, I want this. Can you please just do that?
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of collaboration.
Yeah.
I love working in team.
Yeah. A film's perfect for that.
Yeah. Well, you think about it. I mean, you can never go, and this is what I love about filmmaking. You know, as a director, you can't ever go, oh, look at what I made. Because actually, you know, there's 137 people on the crew and there was 100 principal cast, 1,000 extras, and then in post, probably another 100 people. You know, so when you add those numbers up, like, it's pretty disingenuous to be like, oh, look at what I made, right? Like, yes, you're a big hand in that, but you've got some key collaborations that without them, it's not going to be as rich of a story. They're going to bring insight and ideas that you're not going to have.
Yeah.
And so I think if you can let those provoke you, you know, just like I like going to cinemas and being provoked by story, I like being provoked by people. And that, I don't think that needs to be negative, right? That's not like you're sitting in there arguing about it. It's just that they will challenge the way you're looking at either that character moment or that sequence of the story or the whole story as a big picture.
Yeah.
So, you know, when a couple of years ago, a buddy of mine, Jonas Myron, who wrote 10,000 Reasons and Cornerstone with Matt Redman, writes for Andrea Bocelli and Celine Dion and Lauren Daigle, you know, to name a couple. he and I worked on a film together, and we started on that talking just about the philosophy of how you would incorporate music differently into the storytelling arcs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not just like needle drop, here's a song, yeah, let's just put it in. And so we kind of worked out that we had a very similar philosophy and an understanding of how rhythm and timing works between picture and sound. And so a couple of years later, the opportunity came up on this, and I sent him, I was sitting in church, and I remember clearly because I was quite distracted and fidgeting, and I was writing notes on my phone, and my wife leant over to me and she's like, whatever it is you need to do, you should probably go and do it because everybody in the row knows you want to do something. So I was like, all right.
Texting in church,
writing notes. And so I walked out, and I was going backwards and forwards, right? Because when you ask someone to take a look at your art when it's in rough form,
yeah,
it's kind of vulnerable, right? Like you've got to work through that, and then you've got to work through that feeling of, oh, what if they think it's no good? You know,
yeah.
Like, so it's quite a, I know it's hard sometimes to get up and be like, this is what I think is good. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Right? Do you agree with that? So you have to move past that when you're creating with collaborators.
Yeah.
And just allow them to respond to whatever it is that they're seeing. So I rang Jonas up and I said, hey man, I've got this film that I'm doing. It's in rough format at the moment. You know, gave all the caveats. He said, look, just send it over in Dropbox and I'll have a look at it. And I said, great. And if you get inspired or you feel something, you know, send me an idea of a song that could possibly be in there.
Mm-hmm.
4 days later, he sent me back 2 of the most absolutely gorgeous demos that you could ever hope to hear as a director. And they completely changed the way that I went about the edit. You know, like we actually re-approached and changed the way and the pacing and the way character arcs actually mapped out as a result of those 2 songs. So one of them became William Miller's main theme. They're almost like the internalized expression of the feeling that's going on for that character.
Yeah.
And so they're used, each song is used 3 times. So it has a beginning, middle, and end structure in it. It kind of tracks their emotional interior. So even tonally, those songs express very differently each time that you hear them. And they're in very different parts of that journey. And so, you know, that influence of that, then when he saw how we'd laid them into the edit, Jonas and our composer for the whole score, Blake Robinson, got together, and then they got re-inspired with what they were doing. And then changed their approach to how they were working on music. So they let what we were doing visually with the demos affect the way that they then went through the process of coming back and going, well, what about this? And what if in that moment there's no lyric and actually Jonas is humming, you know, because there are no words really that express that feeling of like,
yeah,
joy and love when you're courting romantically for the first time in, you know, in the 1800s when you've got chaperones walking behind you and stuff, right? Like, yeah. So it just became this beautiful, like, I inspired him to write 2 songs that flowed out of him that re-inspired me to look at those character journeys and how the film actually told its story very differently, which then re-inspired them to express those songs in those moments what are really, really very deeply connected ways that give you something that isn't anything like what you're seeing or what you're hearing from character dialogue. So it's doing something complementary but different, which I always find is really lovely, because if your picture and your sound are just doing the same thing, then you're kind of missing an opportunity to give us more detailed information, particularly on that interior journey side of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Can you talk about what, let's jump in and talk about how people can, so you created this film.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you created it out of? in that mm-hmm. you were working on a larger project. You're Emmy Award winning filmmaker. You've done projects on biblical characters.
Sounds so impressive, doesn't it?
Did stuff on working with Adventist Media, the Hope Channel, in Australia. You've worked with the General Conference. So this film is kind of a discreet Adventist story.
Yeah.
But you've thought about Adventist stories for a while. You've thought about the let's call it the cinematic universe of Adventism, which includes biblical characters too.
Yes.
So, you know, why did you tell this story in this beautiful way versus some of the other stories that are out there and the biblical stories that you've done before?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, actually, particularly as an artist, as you get a little bit older, you form a really, I guess, clear picture of how you want to engage with storytelling. And I guess when, you know, I spent a lot of my career, I've been really blessed actually. So, you know, working for the church over the years, like, what a training ground. Like, there's very few places that will hand you the kind of resources and opportunities. On the flip side to that, there's a certain restriction in there because you're not telling your story, you're telling a larger, more corporate version of that, if that's a way to articulate
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know, which is totally fine. Like, I'm not paying the bill, right? Like, mm-hmm. so if I'm hired by an organization to tell the story the way that they want it to be told, and it's a challenge, actually. It was a challenge for me when I was younger doing this, because you have this idea of storytelling as a singular voice and a singular artist, right?
Yeah.
So I've got a way of storytelling. The client, for want of a better word, has an outcome that they want from that. And sometimes it's hard to reconcile those two things, right? Like, storytelling by a committee and storytelling by a singular voice are two very different things.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they have one. One doesn't have to be better or worse or indifferent or whatever it is. They're just very, very different.
Yeah.
So if you're approaching those as a singular artist, expecting that the want of the many voices is going to always agree with you, you're going to sorely be disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like, there's going to be a lot of disappointment.
You're not going to be hopeful.
You're not going to be hopeful. Well, you're going to be hopeful
gonna
for
hit
a
all
while.
The names.
But you're going to run into some things that are simply just. And I think a lot of the time, Alex, it's misunderstanding, right? Like, it's not understanding what you've signed up for.
Yeah.
And particularly for me, like, it took me a long time to realize, this is like, I'm serving something,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not necessarily the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's another purpose outside
sure,
of that.
Sure, sure. Promotional, right? That kind of thing.
Whatever it be, or we've got a certain way that we need to. And again, these things aren't bad. And I think that's what people misunderstand and why sometimes people get frustrated when they work for church organizations, particularly in media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the church needs certain things from their content,
mm-hmm.
which aren't necessarily compatible with great storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you think about what a church needs to be able to do. Like, it needs to preach
mm-hmm.
the message.
Yeah.
Preaching is not great as a form of storytelling in narrative fiction.
Yeah.
Or, you know, narrative true story or whatever it be, right? Like, that, you know, when you walk into a cinema, there's a unspoken contract in the cinema, right? Like, one of those is going to be that I'm going to be in a dark room
uh-huh.
and I'm going to be with a load of other people, and we're all going to suspend our disbelief that we're sitting in sometimes a space that smells a little bit because the carpet hasn't been changed.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of stale popcorn odor in the air. And we're going to suspend that, and we're going to get transported to whatever magical place
yeah.
that the storyteller that we're about to watch is going to take us. If at any moment somebody pops up and tries to tell me what I should think or feel or do in that moment, in that space, I'm out.
Yeah.
Because that's not the contract I signed up for, right? Yeah. I signed up for getting provoked and going on a journey, and it's going to be magical and mystical, and there's going to be these fabulous places I've never seen before, and there's going to be these characters that are struggling and dealing with things just like I have to, but in such situations that maybe I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
And that's going to allow me to feel feelings that maybe aren't safe out in the world that I walk around in reality. But feeling those feelings for 2 hours in that safe environment is going to allow me to start thinking deeper about issues in my own life and how I might handle certain things. And but that's mine,
yeah,
right? That's my interior thought process. That's for me to decide how I feel about that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those, you know, those two imperatives, one being, you know, that we have a mission and we have to tell, which is great, but it isn't great in cinema.
No.
It's not, that's not its place.
It's not even great in church, let's be honest, most of the time.
You know, most of the time, unless you've got someone who's a really great orator,
yeah,
right? Exactly. Like great oration can actually, like I was sat. Where was I? Listening to Barry Black.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, who's the U.S. Senate chaplain. And, I mean, that man's like, you can listen to him for hours on end, like literally. Like, yeah. He just has a way and a tone and a cadence and a rhythm and an ability to just kind of place an idea.
Yeah.
And then just let it sit there. And you're spellbound by it, right? Like, you're sitting there going, it's not that I want you to hurry up. It's just I can't wait to hear, like, what's the punchline to that idea that you just dropped in front of us and now we're all looking at it.
Yeah.
You've just got this beautiful ability to put ideas into time and space in front of you. But if you were to watch that same thing back on YouTube, it wouldn't have the same resonance as it did live. You know, like I was sitting maybe about this distance from where he was speaking, and so the engagement and the effect of him talking to a live audience is very different to how that actually comes across on taped media.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like if you were sitting in the room here with us right now, it would feel very different to how it's going to feel as you're watching it wherever you're watching it, right? Yeah. Whether it be on your phone on a tiny screen or on your television, yeah, or laptop or whatever.
Yeah.
Like sitting in the room feels different.
Yeah. So let's, for folks who want to watch The Hopeful.
Yes.
And have this kind of experience,
yeah,
a cinematic experience, they can do it in a theater.
They can. They can go to
Ellen White has said, yes, we can do that now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but.
Well, no, there's some fabulous
things. It's about her, so the angels will be in the room.
And actually, this is the hilarious thing because, you know, you can go on. I mean, the White Estate cleared this up literally years ago, Alex. And it's actually fascinating to me that like there's questions about whether. So, for a start, when she talks about theater, cinema hasn't even been invented yet.
Yeah.
So there's literally zero context for her to be talking about cinema, yeah, for a start.
Mm-hmm.
And she was referring to one very specific theater where there were bawdy plays,
yeah,
of a vaudeville variety,
yeah,
where,
yeah,
people would go to do certain transactions in that theater up the back. So it was very site specific,
yeah,
to a very specific time and place.
Like many of her
prohibitions. Things, right? So if we translate those very site specific, time specific, and person specific,
yeah,
onto just blanket general, I mean,
global statements.
That's where you're always going to get in trouble because you're taking something very much out of context,
yeah,
and not putting it in the context and then looking at it for what it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can see The Hopeful in glorious 4K, sounding great, beautiful on a 40-foot cinema screen in over 900 cinemas across the country.
And what,
starting April 17th.
April 17, great.
And if you go to fathomevents.com,
yeah,
/ The Hopeful, you can get tickets there either, you know, for you and a couple of people. You can also, there's a group booking button on there, so you can take 50 people, so
for instance. If you have like a youth group, you could take a youth group. 100%. If you're a pastor, you could take a whole church. If you're a conference leader, you could take the whole conference.
You could take the whole conference and take several screenings book those out, you know.
Have camp meeting at the theater.
Well, and actually, I think there's a real opportunity here for, so it's not just about, and this is going to sound weird coming from the guy that made it, but it isn't actually just about the film, right? Like, it's what the film actually
provokes
and creates an opportunity for, which is for you actually to get out and engage in conversation with the community that you live and operate in.
I'm glad you used that line, because Spectrum's motto is create community through conversation.
This movie might help us accomplish our mission. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's in a funny kind of way, right? Like, I think sometimes, you know, we've all got those friends that we've had for a while, 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
That for some unknown reason, at some point at the beginning of that friendship, we friend-zoned our faith with them.
Yeah.
And then very quickly after that, it becomes really difficult to insert any conversation about that in, because it's not now organic and natural. So 10 years down the track, they know a lot about our life, except this period of time on the weekend, right, where they know we disappear into an ether of this thing called Sabbath,
yeah,
right? And they know that sometimes they can't get hold of us during that period of time.
Yeah.
But they don't really know why, and they feel uncomfortable to ask, because now it's been too long and we probably should have asked that up front, but we just didn't, you know? What a fabulous opportunity to go, hey, I got a couple of tickets. Do you guys want to come on Wednesday or Thursday and we'll go do dinner and a movie together? You know? And they're going to have an incredible conversation with you afterwards, because they're suddenly going to recognize a whole bunch of things, even in their own life, that they have anticipated, and stuff that they've been disappointed about, and things that they've persevered to get to, right? So despite all of these other distractions, that really clear, simple thing that they wanted to hold on to, that they had to persevere towards. And you're going to have a beautiful conversation, and it's not going to be infused with anything else other than your guy's personal experience, because they're your friends.
Yeah.
You know, so they're getting to engage with you about something that's really deeply meaningful in your life. And I think that, I mean, that's the power of cinema, right? Like, it allows us personal engagement with each other around big topics that we all struggle through. You know, I think that's the power of The Hopeful, actually, is its ability to give that opportunity that, you know, we probably haven't had, particularly not in an Adventist context. You know, when's the last time prior to maybe Hacksaw Ridge?
Yeah.
You know, but that was an R-rated film. This is very much family friendly, so you can take everyone to it and have a great experience.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit of a unique opportunity for Adventists to be able to actually go, wow, here's something I can go to. It's world class. I don't have to feel like I'm going to be embarrassed about my faith with the person that came along with me, because there's a little bit of a cringe factor. And I can tell you that with all certainty, Alex, because that was one of the big things that I sat down originally and went, if I'm going to make a film about my faith, I do not want to sit in cinemas all across the world for the next however many years I'm going to be doing that with a lot of my friends who aren't of either my faith or of any faith, really. You know, like, I just want to have a credible conversation with them and not feel weird.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about you, but like, I don't like being weird. And I probably am. We're all probably a little bit weird.
Well, that makes you very non-weird.
Yeah. But I get very uncomfortable with being weird. So when when people point out something that you do that's a little bit quirky, sometimes you're like, really? I do that? Wow, that's awkward. I should probably stop doing that, because that makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know? I don't like
Adventism does that in some ways.
Well, yeah, and we've cultivated that, right? Like, if you think about, you know, we're a peculiar people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to be a peculiar person. Branding. That's terrible branding. Like, the last thing I want to do is be peculiar.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be passionate. I want to provoke thought in other people, and I want to be someone who really engages in deep and meaningful conversation, but also frivolous conversation that people laugh at that isn't like that deep and meaningful, right?
Yeah.
But what I don't want to be is people look at you and go, yeah, no. You know, like that's your thing. You go and sit over there. That's kind of creeping me out now.
So this, you know, the hopeful is not going to be a weird Adventist movie.
Ooh.
Instead, it's going to be what? What do you really hope it accomplishes?
Well, I'll tell you, and I can only tell you from my personal experience, right? Like, so for me, up until 2 years ago, which, you know, I'll date myself here, but at 43, my comfort zone is not sitting talking to people openly about my faith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be the guy who goes door knocking. I'm not handing out flyers on a street corner.
Yeah.
I'm not out telling you, you know, repent now or you shall be, you know.
All right. We'll have to cut this out so Ted Wilson doesn't down and find you.
I would qualify that, Alex. So, like, I have actually a lot of respect for people that can do that because it takes a lot of, I don't know, guts. Like, literature evangelists, for instance. So, my dad was the 52 years at Science Publishing Company in Warburton. Started sweeping the floors, ended up finishing out his career for like 20-something years as production manager. Yeah. So
we love our Science friends in Australia.
Yes, it's Nathan Brown.
Good breed.
Shout out to you.
Yeah. Hey, Nathan.
So you've got this rich like publishing tradition. And I would often, you know, when I was a kid, you know, 15 years old, 16 years old, I would go and pull books off the shelf that these guys had gone out and sold door to door.
Yeah.
And I would often find myself thinking, I'm like, man, alive, can you imagine walking up to a door uninvited and knocking on that? But not only doing that, ending up having like a whole conversation with them and then selling them books. Like, there is no way.
Yeah.
You know? But seeing the effect of that on people's lives, you go, wow, like what perseverance that is. Like, I recognize and I am appreciative that people do have that.
Yeah.
But again, you have a look at it, like on any bell curve, right? Take all the people in Adventism. On any bell curve, there's going to be 4% of those people who are weird good, 4% who are going to be weird bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle, there's going to be 92% of people who don't really quite know how they're going to navigate that faith life balance, right?
Yeah.
Like, am I, like, I may have gone door knocking one time.
Yeah.
Probably not, because again, it's not my comfort zone.
Yeah.
But to where this actually has an impact and why this is relevant to the hopeful, it was in putting that film through post-production in Sydney at the Post Lounge. Incredible post facility, you know, loads of big Hollywood features going through there. Baz Luhrmann had just done Elvis in there. So I'm in there and I'm telling the Adventist story. People walk past your edit suite every now and again, or people you're working with who have worked on some of, you know, the biggest Hollywood films out there.
Yeah.
Start asking you, hey, Carl, like, what's this Sabbath thing?
Yeah.
And for the first time in your life, you're forced to actually go, huh, how do I articulate that when someone's genuinely asking me out of interest, not out of like looking at you weirdly about it, not like they're genuinely asking you because they're actually interested about what this thing Sabbath is. And oh, and then they find out you actually observe it and they get even more fascinated by it. And so then you're presented with the reality of, wow, how do I articulate this thing that as a lifelong Adventist I just take for granted, you know?
Yeah.
And am I comfortable talking about that? And how do I get comfortable talking about that? Because good grief, I'm making a film now, and if this thing actually goes to cinema like we hope it will, I'm going to have to talk a lot about this, you know? So very quickly you realize that actually there's a lot of comfort and relaxed joy in being able to feel like you can honestly go, yeah, I don't always feel comfortable. I don't always have the answers. And that's kind of okay.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the point of telling this story, is that it allows you to go, I am proud of my faith as an Adventist. I do actually love those core, absolutely core values that actually Adventism was founded on, which when you look at what those early members really locked into, they locked into coming out of disappointment and with all the other stuff going on. We're now destitute. We don't have houses because we sold them. People are ridiculing us in the street. But there was something about the character of Christ that they saw originally that Miller really painted vividly, particularly for Ellen. So Ellen, the first time she ever hears him, she goes back that evening and she says to her parents, I've never heard Jesus described as a healer before, right? I've heard of his wrath and I've heard of his judgment, but his healing, like, that's beautiful, you know? And when you think about everything that these guys went through on that journey through disappointment out the other side to working out, so how do we reconcile what we're disappointed by, which is him not coming back, with the character that we got to recognize and fell in love with?
Yeah.
And so when you look at the outworking of that, like, what are Adventists really good at? Hospitals, development relief agencies, and education. And so when you look at the healing and the hopeful message that we believe we've been uniquely tasked with giving to people, I think that, man, hope and healing's a pretty great offering to the Protestant canon of Christianity.
Yeah.
Like, if that's all you go, so what is my purpose and my role out in the community? It's to give hope and to bring healing. Okay, that's pretty great. I think I can sign up to that.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I think I think I can sit comfortably with people and operate under that. You know.
So the hopeful talks to us about hope and gives us a nice vision for Adventism as a community that brings healing. As we wrap here, just remind folks how they can see this and when they can see it.
Yeah, so they can go to fathomevents.com/thehopeful, or they can go to thehopefulmovie.com and then click on buy tickets. There's also buy group tickets or request a booking, request the screening in your local area. So yes, there's 900 screens across the US. So it's likely that you're going to click on buy tickets and it's going to show you. I just looked around this area this morning on my way here. There's like 15 cinemas in like a 5-mile radius.
We're in Los Angeles.
We're in Los Angeles. You'd expect that. But even in smaller places like that I've been traveling around the last couple of weeks, you look on where they are and it's surprising how close they are to an Adventist church.
Great.
So, but if there isn't one near you, go on there and request, you know, say, this is my location. This is where I am. I'd like to like get a number of tickets to this and request that and get that cinema on board.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great talking with you. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it. Great.